how engagé one should be or one can be. James Baldwin, would you like to start the ball rolling on that?
Well, it's a question like an artichoke, isn't it? Because if one tries, for example, to goad the whites, which is another way of saying that you're trying to force into the public attention something which menaces the public, in this case, this country.
No, by goading, I mean acting as a gadfly, stinging them into thinking, into doing. And I think you have, to a large extent, been successful in that in recent years.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, but I had to take a rather sparing tone about that. Because in order to be a gadfly, in order to goad a conscience, the conscience has got to be at least alive, not to say present, you know.
Are you saying that the American whites have no conscience or a dead conscience? Or?
Not quite, though I could say that. What I am trying to say is that they are, in general, so brainwashed. That is to say, they have created a myth which they call the American Negro, which has nothing to do with the life of anybody I know. It's an abstraction. But they believe it. Now, in order to goad this conscience, or, you know, to reach this sensibility, you got to force them to examine why they ever created this myth. Since the myth is involved with their property values, I mean, their position in the world, in short, and with much more private things, their relationship to themselves, to their children, to their wives, to their expectations of life, to their sexuality. If you're trying to crack the myth that they've created, they react, in general, with tremendous panic. And more than ever, and again in general, retreat, which is, as I see it now, part of the problem in this country, that the white majority is not prepared to give up, or even in a way does not know how to give up, its extraordinary need for the nigger. And that means they all their behavior is predicated on this, and therefore they ask you in all seriousness, what does the Negro want? Now, that's an infantile question coming from an infantile people. The problem here is to get the people in this country to grow up. And the danger is whether or not there's enough time.
And you, are you trying perhaps to frighten them into growing up quickly when you say the fire next time?
Well, not really. You know, the fire next time is not a phrase that I invented.
No.
It comes out of the Bible, it comes out of, you know, the slave songs. It was a spiritual for long before I was born. And they didn't hear it then. You know, one hopes that they would begin to hear it now. But it's not a menacing title unless, of course, you believe what most white Americans believe, that you are menaced by the presence of black people in your country. Of course, I am trying to suggest that if one does not deal with it, then chaos results, not merely for black people, but for the entire country, by which I also mean to say the entire West, and that includes England.
Well, Leroy Jones, in your play Dutchman, when you have one of the characters stab the other, there sometimes come screams from the audience. They did the night that I was there. And I would say that your play is definitely a frightening play. Now, it's certainly an engagé work because it concerns the problem very much indeed. So what is your attitude toward working within the framework of art and at the same time advancing the cause of civil rights and Negro freedom?
Well, I don't know. I think that you have to write about what you are, and I think that black writers are black, and they are subject to all the things that black people are subject to, maybe even more violently subjected to them, because they want to think about it longer. But you have to write about your life, and if you're a black man, that's part of your life. But people try to make it seem as if when you're talking about black people and their needs and their desires, somehow it's not as valuable as talking about a white man and his desires. But that's not, you know, like a lot of people know that's not true, you know, and most of them are outside of this country, you know, and they know it's not true. It's just like Jimmy says, why do they need a nigger? Well, for one reason, they need it for economic reasons, like to do all the nasty work, you know, in the society. But also, they need it to make them seem larger than life, you know, and they're not larger than life at all. They're like prisoners in their own lives, and their own lives are pretty pathetic now. And a lot of people can tell you that. A lot of people in this country, a lot of people outside of this country, their lives are very, very pathetic.
Well, art, of course, has the tendency to make almost everything seem larger than life. That's perhaps why it is art, if it's effective art. I myself have been writing for 40 years about the plight of the Negro in America, and I have very often been called a propaganda writer. Well, in the old days, that was considered rather a bad word. But my feeling is that art and propaganda can be one and the same thing. Yes, Leroy, would you
know? No, I was going to say, in that sense, you know, you can call Dante a propagandist for you know, certain kind of values, certain kind of moral fix on the world. But it's just that certain people, if they disagree with your attitudes, you know, then they're going to call it propaganda, and by calling it propaganda, what they mean is it has no artistic value simply because it's about something they disagree with. But that's, you know...
Well, when art is related to social values and related to attempts to change a social system
it
or social
can't be,
pattern...
I don't think it can be taken out of its social... I mean, art exists in the world like everything else, and it has a social connotation. It has a social direction, whether the writer admits it or is conscious of it or not, it exists as a socially oriented kind of expression. It cannot help that. It exists in the world like everything else.
Yes, as a social act, or rather what is called an antisocial act.
But I myself think that many Negro writers are social or propaganda writers without consciously being so, due to the very fact of their situation in our society. Would you not agree with that, Miss Childers?
Yes, I would. I think you can't help it. You're in it. For example, one thing I'd like to say about the Negro writer almost everywhere, we're not free. We're just not. So that out of our lack of freedom, I try to think that I write what I please and as I please and how I feel, and I don't know if I've ever achieved that in my life with anything that I've ever written.
Well, we
even though I try not to do any conscious capitulation, it's with you wherever you go, and as long as there are laws, you know, where you can't go here, you can't travel here, you can't live here, you can't what do I have to say about Mississippi, forgetting, I mean, in its entirety, speaking for all America, you know. I can't even live in such a way in Mississippi. We cannot participate in Mississippian life in such a way as to enter completely into it. We can speak from an outside position. And I also think we have to face the fact that there are great, great many people who don't care, who are not going to care in a hurry, you know, tomorrow afternoon or 10 years from now. And I don't know exactly what to do about it, you know, as far as any movements or what, except more self-realization, more self-confidence. And I don't know where we're going to get it from, out of thin air, out of thin air.
Of course, our books are burned in Mississippi. I mean, the freedom schools, the libraries, half a dozen of them have been bombed, and books of mine that I've sent down there for the students have simply been burnt up this summer. What sort of interests me is that one of our most famous writers, recently deceased, Richard Wright, lived in Paris for about 15 years, the latter part of his life. One of our most successful commercial writers, Frank Yerby, lives in the south of France, and Chester Himes is living in Paris now. Well, now, James Baldwin, you lived in Paris, didn't you, for about 10 years, I believe?
Not quite.
What I've heard,
quite a
number of years.
Yeah.
Do you think that this problem that Alice Childers has just brought up, the problem of perspective, of writing clearly, of knowing what to do about things, is in any sense solved by living abroad or getting a perspective from another country?
It's an individual question in a way, you know. As, for example, it seems, in general, to work for Chester, you know, and for a while, it worked for me.
Yeah.
I don't, on the other hand, think that it worked, this is my own opinion, I don't think that it worked for Richard. So my tentative conclusion about that is that during the years I lived in Paris, one very important thing happened first before anything else happened. And that was that I was no longer in physical danger of destruction by my countrymen. You know, that I could be myself without literally courting death. And that had then an effect in my mind which allowed me to be free to deal with some things that were on my mind. And insofar as anyone can pretend that he has ever grown up, you know, if I grew up, I grew up in those 9 years in Paris. But as opposed to that, and very sharply opposed to that, what I had to realize also was that I was living in exile, whether or not it was self-willed, and it was not really self-willed, since in the way I'd been driven out, and that the Algerians in Paris and the Senegalese in Paris were living in a very different Paris, and that the French society was, when the chips were down, indistinguishable from any other Western European white imperialist society, and that I was protected, in effect, by the fact that I was no threat to them. I had a green passport, and there were only 500 of us scattered around Paris. And this meant then that I had to make a choice of my own, which was whether or not it was more valuable for me in terms of, you know, if I were going to try to fulfill myself as a person and as a writer, to stay there in a society for which I had no responsibility, in which I didn't have to pay any dues, mm-hmm. surrounded by people who were paying dues all the time. And if I did that, what would happen to me in terms of the society which I'd left, you know, which I spent a lot of time sitting around talking to Frenchmen about and never understood it, for the same reasons that nobody understands it here, and talking about Algerians whom I, after all, I lived with and whom the French did not understand. So I came home. But it seemed to me that I could choose two ways of perishing. I could perish there by pretending I'd become a European, or I could perish here, you know, by submitting again to the literal, you know, danger of death.
You know, some of our writers are now going not to Paris, where many, many American writers have seemingly halfway grown up, as you sort of implied, but are going to Africa. Dr. Du Bois, you know, in his very old age, went to live in Ghana and died there. Ted Jones, a few years ago, went to live in Morocco. Julian Mayfield now lives in Accra. And the last and latest writer, to my knowledge, to go to Africa is William Gardner Smith, who left the other day from Paris to live in Africa. Do you think, Leroy, that Africa is going to have an increasing effect on the way our American Negro writers think and feel, an increasing pull for them? What does it mean to you?
Well, Africa, I'd like to go to Africa, and I'd like to go to Africa and see it, and be there, but I don't know, you know, it's very complicated because, you know, the Africans going through, in a sense, pretty much some of the same things we are going through. You know, they've got their Uncle Toms, or what you call them, Uncle Shombies. I mean, they might be more, they're even more murderous. They're more murderous than, you know, the American Uncle Toms, because they got more power at their disposal. I mean, there's some poets, too, over there who are sort of coming up very light, you know, politically and socially. But I'd like to go and see it, you know. I feel, you know, you have to feel a kinship with a black person, because I was riding up here from the, you know, my home and saying, thinking about a poem, I would begin by saying, well, you have to be pretty strange to live in countries full of white people. You know, it would make you strange after a while. And I would like to, yeah, I know, that's what I mean. I'd like to go and see, you know, see what, how the other half lives, see what's happening, you know. I might like it. I might even, I'd like to go to Kenya. In Zanzibar.
There seems to be something of a tendency to consider white people not quite human.
I look at it strictly as results. I'm not trying to make a big program. I'm saying that, like this man Les Crane told me that, you know, like, I'm not responsible for this, but I met white people all my life and none of them are responsible, but mm-hmm. somebody has got to be responsible. They told me each one I've met has said, hey, not responsible. But there is somebody, and some of them who are responsible.
Yes, it's like the old thing of not being served a cup of coffee in a restaurant, and the manager telling you it's not me who objects, it's my patron.
Well, look, the right wing says this is a white man's country, and they're right. It is a white man's country. So that, then that means if there's something bad going on in it, like he at least has his final say about it, you know, whether, you know, I mean, he's at least there to see it go down, you know.
I don't think we should treat them as though they're gods and goddesses, though, because there are a great many white people who can't be responsible because they don't know as much as they should. They don't
have an understanding.
So they cannot be responsible. Now, those who have understanding and know what they're doing are quite responsible, but I think, for example, if the school situation were out of the way, why the next struggle would be what is taught in the schools, because white people would find out they're not getting the best kind of education, you know.
Or any education at all.
They feel they don't have to appeal or fight for anything for themselves. That is completely a Negro.
But a lot of white people who are not, say, running the machinery of, like, oppression are still running it because, like, say, some Italian who has just moew to, you know, moved out to, like, Kew Gardens, and, like, feels he finally made it into, like, white America, and him, that feeling he has of, like, stopping the Negro in his tracks because he's some threat to him, he is, like, functioning. He's functioning for a different kind of white man, you know, but he's still functioning. The thing is, he is ignorant.
Yes.
And that's a worse sin in the world. He is ignorant, because if he listened and saw... And so what
but
they
a lot
to
of this ignorance
father,
is taught out of textbooks, actually.
Most of it, yeah.
Right,
yes,
don't
but
you
that,
think?
A lot of it is taught out of textbooks, indeed. In fact, most of it. But at the point that, you know, he himself is a man, it is not only the textbooks, you know. Mm-hmm. It is also the fact that, to take Leroy's example, that the cat who finally makes it to Kew Gardens believes, for example, you know, that if a Negro moves in, his property values fall down. And this is a country which lives on credit. You know, nothing is paid for. There's a fantastic panic which ensues.
They'll have to pay one day.
No down payment. And the panic, you know, does not allow him to suddenly realize that it is not because I move in that his property values fall, but because he moves out.
I'm not relieving him of responsibility. I'm simply saying why more isn't forthcoming. Some of them, we have to face the fact some people have very little to give. You know, others have more, and you could try to tap it forever, and, you know, you could waste a great many years trying to...
Well, we all know that the black Muslim position is that America has nothing to give the black man anymore, and like a burning house, do you still want to be a part of it or not? And Julian Mayfield has, in a sense, expressed that very well in something that he wrote in an article not long ago. He says, this new approach is suggested by the Negro mother, who, having lost one of her sons in the Korean adventure, was heard to remark, I don't care if the army is integrated. Next time, I want to know what kind of war my boy is being taken to. And then Mayfield goes on to say that the Negro writer may conclude that his best salvation lies in escaping the narrow national orbit, artistic, cultural, and political, and soaring into the space of more universal experience. Well, now, that's a bit idealistic. I mean, can any of us soar into space, really, apart from the mud that our feet are mired in? Alice, what do you think about
it? Well, I'd like to... say a word or two about my play in connection with that.
Which play? Trouble in Mind?
No,
or your new
Wedding
one?
Band that has, you know,
is coming up. Yes.
It's an interracial story about a white man and a Negro woman who wish to marry each other in South Carolina. They would like to. It's a case of the law. It's not star-crossed lovers. You know, East is East and West is West, never the twain shall meet. They would like to, and the play starts 10 years after they've met each other, so we're not going through does he really and does she really and so forth. They do.
They love each other.
They love each other.
Yeah.
It's not possible for them to leave South Carolina, but they're American citizens and they're citizens of the state of South Carolina. For example, this talk about soaring, and I agree with you, you can't get your feet off the ground because most of the states have laws not only against intermarriage, so that there is no responsibility and so forth for our children, even from slavery. It would take so long. How many hundreds, thousands of laws are on all of these books with the kind of fines Fornication is $30 fine, and intermarriage is $10,000 fine. So that the more honorable the aspiration of the couple, the heavier the fine, you know. Now, this sort of thing is set down, and also where you have two people who acknowledge a child and say it is theirs and put it down on the birth certificate, they shall both be liable to jail, long jail sentences and so forth. These things are never discussed. They're always a sort of vague kind of thing, how I feel about you and how you feel about me. I hear a great deal of this in my heart, how I feel in your heart, but there are thousands upon thousands of laws against Negro people here that we know of. Now, as far as the school is concerned, due to the mixing from slavery right up to now, due to this, and the school struggle, we haven't only been trying to get our children and grandchildren into school. We have been struggling to get the grandchildren of white people, Arthurie and Lucy and so forth, into these schools, and they've stood outside and stoned them. Now, how do you get to soar into space when every day all of this is pulling you back? I've often wondered what it would feel like to go in an ivory tower, just write anything.
Well, my feeling is that there's so much wonderful, exciting, dramatic material, such as you've just been describing, to write about without soaring into space, that one doesn't need to, except artistically, perhaps. What can we do with words to make the sordidness of our problems effective and beautiful?
What about even the sordid part, when I said the very quantity and quality of what you have to say, that for you say, where will I go with this? Who wants to hear this? I'm not saying, for example, that all white writers write exactly what they please, but I think they have been sold so much on being white and believing that it is everything that they have forgotten to struggle for themselves.
They have a much easier time than we Negro writers do. That is certainly true.
And they have their hardships, too.
We have periods where we are perhaps in vogue. I think maybe this is one where it's not too difficult to get a book published if you are a Negro. When this period is gone, there comes a time when, as my publishers have said to me, we don't want a Negro author this season because we have one on our list.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And we are categorized, racially speaking, even in the arts. The same thing is true on Broadway. There was a great lull between the Broadway of the late 1920s and early 30s when there were innumerable reviews and Florence Mills and Ethel Waters and the Green Pastures and the Paul Green plays, the Eugene O'Neill plays. Then there was about 15 years when it was almost impossible to get a play produced on Broadway by a Negro writer or on a Negro subject.
Well, even now, my play was postponed when Jimmy Baldwin's play was going on because they say, well, there'll be one on and we'd better wait and, you know, and just see and let, you know, so that,
yeah.
Certainly, yeah. This doesn't happen. You know, there are about 60 or 70.
No, it doesn't. It does not. No. The producers will say, well, look, I have a Negro script I'm considering. I don't need another one. And so, economically speaking, our problems are, I think, greater than the white writers. And, of course, the whole history of Hollywood has been that we've been practically barred out of Hollywood until very recent years, entirely barred. And the agents would say to me, I can't sell you in Hollywood. You're a Negro writer, and Hollywood won't buy a Negro writer. No, I'm an American. You see, I grew up in the middle of American Kansas. I know white people as well as they know me. I can write about them as well as they write about me. And yet, most of the Hollywood pictures about Negroes, as we all know, have been written by whites. They think that whites can write better about Negroes than Negroes about themselves. And they make the $50,000 fees or whatever they...
And they actually tell the Negro writer, we've heard enough about that. You know, after they've discussed it for two or three shows, they said, well, we've heard enough on that subject, you know?
Well, I have just heard that James Baldwin has sold his play to Hollywood. Jimmy, you might tell us if that is true, if you have it. It's a very lucky thing for you.
Well, it's very revealing, too, I think. No. I'm not exactly sold it to Hollywood. I sold it to Tony Richardson, who's an English director.
Who's an English director, that's right.
Who's working in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
The book has been around for a while, and the only interest Hollywood evinced in it was involved with, you know, rearranging a story and about doing maybe one third of
it. Are they going to make the story white? Because they did that with Alan Lucasta, didn't they?
No. I am writing the script.
Oh, good.
I may make many mistakes, but I won't make that mistake. But the point is, it's not Hollywood that's bought the book.
Oh, yeah.
And as far as I know, it's not Hollywood that's financing it. It's being done, you know, by your star, Mr. Richardson.
Sure.
Who is perhaps the only person alive at the moment who would, you know, dream of doing it. Certainly the only person who happens to find himself physically in Hollywood who would dream of doing it.
Well, what we've just been talking about comes to one point which I should like to have your opinions on. That is the economics of writing. Miss Childress touched upon it when she said that it was impossible for her to write always the sort of plays and things that she would like to write because there is not always a market for them. Now, do you find that that is an inhibiting factor as you're sitting down to write? Do you consciously consider what is going to sell, what is not going to sell,
no.
And to whom?
No, if I may interrupt, I think Alice's point was rather more involved than that, if I may say.
Right.
You know, the economic factor is very real. We'll come to that in a minute. But the great question in one's own mind is the extent to which you yourself are brainwashed.
Your spirit's been
broken. And to which, to what extent exactly your spirit's been broken. You know, do you yourself know any longer? You know, when you sit down to do this or that, you know, to describe this character, is it really your vision or are you intimidated by that invisible army of, you know, those eyes over your shoulder? And are you unconsciously, you know, lying about your experience? Because if you are lying about your experience, which is the gravest question any writer can face, you know, then you're simply, you know, courting your death.
And unconsciously is worst of all.
Yes, that's right, because the economic thing in that context is compatible.